From KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Jeffrey Callison. Nominees for this year's prestigious Quill Award in poetry include Maya Angelou, Garrison Keillor, and William O'Daly of Auburn. You'll meet him and hear some of his work today on Insight. So today, another distinguished local poet. It's Taylor Graham and her latest award-winning collection, The Downstairs Dance Floor. Plus, a story booth is touring the Sierra, recording people's stories about the Sierra Nevada mountains. You'll hear a clip from one story, you won't believe the age of the man who's speaking, and you'll find out where the story booth is going next. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, personal stories of the Sierra. There's a story booth touring the region. You'll hear a wonderful clip from one story that's already recorded. First, we'll check in with two distinguished local poets. One of them is El Dorado County's Taylor Graham. Her latest collection is The Downstairs Dance Floor, an award-winning group of poems inspired by old family photos, letters, and anecdotes. We'll start, though, with William O'Daly. He's a poet in Auburn, and he's nominated for this year's Quill Award in Poetry for his translation of a book of poems by Pablo Neruda. Other nominees include Garrison Keillor and Maya Angelou, but we're not going to bother with them today. Instead, we'll focus on William O'Daly. He's in our studio. William, thanks for joining us on Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Well, you're up for a top national award with literary royalty. How does that feel?
I was shocked. It feels very good, and not something especially a translator would expect.
Is it unusual for translators to be competing with people who are writing poems in their own right?
Well, sometimes books of translation, regardless of the poet, original poet, are excluded. And with the Quill Awards, nothing's excluded.
Okay. Tell us then how the Quill Awards work.
Well, 6,000 booksellers and librarians nominate their favorite books of the year, the books they feel deserve notoriety. And after that, it's a bit of a black box. I'm not really sure, but it originates in the grassroots, essentially. And then the public votes for their favorite book in one of 19 categories, poetry, creative nonfiction, illustrated novels, etc. And then any of those books are eligible for Book of the Year.
So it's American Idol for literary people.
Exactly.
And what does that mean? Does that mean that the do you think that improves your chances or worsens them?
I think it improves them.
Yes.
Pablo Neruda has an incredible following internationally as well as in the United States. And the book is a very handsome book. It appears on the website. And I feel that it's a strong book. Naturally, I would.
Yes. And it's called Still Another Day. That is, that's not an exact translation of what Neruda called it, which was, correct my pronunciation if it's wrong, Aún.
Aún is correct.
And that means, and yet.
Yeah, or still, yes.
Or still. Mm-hmm. Why did you call it Still Another Day in English?
Well, and yet, or still wouldn't work very well in English. It doesn't carry the same connotations exactly as it does in Spanish, Chilean Spanish. And so I went with the full tenor of the book. What was Neruda addressing with Aún? And the book itself is about Neruda having one more day to say goodbye to his country, to his readers throughout the world, and one more day to clarify his earthly duties, if you will, what he was placed here on earth to do, if one can believe that after a 45-year, at that point, career in poetry.
Did you approach this book first of all as a poet and second as a translator of Spanish, or did you start out first and foremost as a translator of Spanish who's interested in poetry?
Very much as a poet who had been told by a couple of mentors that the best thing a young poet could do to improve his skills and to reach out to widen his range and scope would be to translate the best poetry of other cultures and languages.
Terrific. Well, we're going to hear something, and let's start with the first poem in the book, if we may.
Certainly.
And in your book, Still Another Day, we see the originals by Neruda on the left side and then your translation in English on the right. And I'd love to hear a sample of the Spanish original. Could you read us at least some of poem one by Neruda?
Certainly. Apologies to the native Spanish speakers out there. Hoy es el día más, el que traía una desesperada claridad que murió. Que no lo sepan los agazapados, todo debe quedar entre nosotros, día, entre tu campana y mi secreto. Hoy es el ancho invierno de la comarca olvidada, que con una cruz en el mapa y un volcán en la nieve, viene a verme, a volverme, a devolverme el agua desplomada en el techo de mi infancia. Hoy cuando el sol comenzó con sus espigas a contar el relato más claro y más antiguo, con una cimitarra cayó la oblíquula lluvia, la lluvia que agradece mi corazón amargo. Tú, mi bella, dormida aún en agosto, mi reina, mi mujer, mi extensión, geografía, beso de barro, cítara que cubren los carbones, tú, vestidura de mi porfiado canto, hoy otra vez renaces y con el agua negra del cielo me confundes y me obligas. Debo reanudar mis huesos en tu reino. Debo aclarar aún mis deberes terrestres.
That's William O'Daly reading a poem by Pablo Neruda. Sounds sad, the way you read it.
Well, in a way, I was imitating, if you will, Neruda's voice, but it's very much that melancholy of southern Chile, the rain-soaked forests of southern Chile.
Was he a sad man?
Oh, on the whole, he has been described as melancholy. He was a sickly child who grew up with a very stern railroad worker father who didn't want any part of this poetry thing he had going.
Yes.
And that's why, actually, he changed his name. His real name isn't Pablo Neruda. From those beginnings, his mother died when he was 2 months old. And from those beginnings, he became a full human being and full of joy as well. Yes, he had that melancholy edge.
Well, before we hear your translation of the poem that you just read in Spanish, tell us how you approached it. How do you sit down with a poem by a master like Neruda and translate it in a correct but also poetic way into English?
Well, what I've learned to do, Jeffrey, it took me 8 years to do this book. I'd work very fully for a year, and I'd take 6 months off and then pull it out again. I was very aware as a young poet of music and the spirit of a poem. How to get that was basically listening to the poem in Spanish, myself reading it into a recorder and playing it back over and over again before I actually even launched into the poem, reading it to myself, listening again, and having that music, you know, get into my bones. But originally I didn't intend to publish this book. It was that a practice. It was the young poet learning his discipline, learning his craft.
Really? Well,
yes.
It turned out pretty well for a practice.
Who would have guessed?
Well, let's hear your translation of the poem that you just read.
All righty. Today is that day, the day that carried a desperate light that since has died. Don't let the squatters know. Let's keep it all between us, day, between your bell and my secret. Today is dead winter in the forgotten land that comes to visit me with a cross on the map and a volcano in the snow. To return to me, to return again the water fallen on the roof of my childhood. Today, when the sun began with its shafts to tell the story so clear, so old, the slanting rain fell like a sword. The rain my hard heart welcomes. You, my love, still asleep in August, my queen, my woman, my vastness, my geography, kiss of mud, the carbon-coated zither, you, vestment of my persistent song. Today you are reborn again, and with the sky's black water, confuse me and compel me. I must renew my bones in your kingdom. I must still uncloud my earthly duties.
That's poet and translator William O'Daly reading from the first poem in his translation of poems by Pablo Neruda. The collection is called Still Another Day, and it's up for a Quill Award for poetry. When I was a literature major, I remember someone saying that that translations are like romantic partners. They're either beautiful and faithless or plain and faithful. Of course, it's just a joke. But I'm sure there's some truth in this. Where do you think it's more important for the translator of a poem to be? To stick as closely as possible to the original, regardless of how that turns out as a poem in English, or the opposite?
Actually, I wouldn't say opposite. I would say it would fall somewhere in between. There is no possible way to create a mirror image of the original poem because one's crossing language and cultures and different histories. But we're all basically human, and at least with Spanish, it's a romance language, which makes it a little easier. But I think what you do as a translator is inevitably transform through a faithfulness to the original. So out of that original poem is born two poems.
English is made up of many influences, but it's at its foundation a Germanic language. As you said, though, Spanish is a Romance language. Does that cause any problems for you as a translator? Because there are just certain sounds that you tend not to find in English that you do find in Romance languages.
Well, English, because it's Germanic, is a little what I would call harder language in terms of sound. Spanish is more rolling. It's more often nuanced in terms of accent. And this was a concern of Neruda's, too, in terms of English translations, although he was very generous and would say, don't just translate me, improve me. And the first thing a good translator knows is not to take that literally. But the music is very important. And you have to remember that sometimes in the target language, English in this case, one creates effects sometimes just through serendipity that aren't in the original. So they're not exact echoes of each other, not that mirror image, but we find wonderful effects in English as well.
Did you take any liberties in these translations where if Pablo Neruda was looking over your shoulder, you'd be going, don't know how I feel about that?
Actually, I never thought he was doing that. He's such a generous spirit. On the other hand, the only time I took liberties, Jeffrey, is when I absolutely had to. A broom in most any language is a broom, and that's not difficult. But the first five words of the poem I just read in the original, poem one of the book, hoy es el día más. Well, you know, immediately I knew I was in trouble, those first five words. And so not knowing quite which way I'd take it, which direction I would go until I had gone through the entire manuscript, I just put my tongue way into my cheek and wrote down, today is the day that is the mostest. And, of course, I knew that wouldn't fly. But that was just my way of creating some sense of, okay, well, what, you know, we'll get back to this. And after reading the entire manuscript, translating thoroughly, I came back to see, well, what's the import of this? And it was, in my mind, today is that day of all days. This is the special day, but it's like every other day.
I guess it's one thing to translate a novel or a short story, which can be poetic, but still it more closely resembles the way that people tend to write and to speak. Poetry is often more abstract and harder to divine exactly what the author is really saying. Is that a problem when you're translating poetry? Because you said there with those first four, five words, you had to really get into what Pablo Neruda was really saying. But how do we really know what he was saying?
Through context. Of course, we aren't him.
But they're the first five words.
Well, that's why I just used that little placeholder there and then moved on. And it was actually not until, I think, the sixth year that I settled on today is that day. I'd lived with the book so long. And I had played with it. I mean, I can't tell you how many versions of those first five words I had. But the most simple was actually the most revealing and the most true to what I felt the tenor of the book was.
That is what you chose. Today is that day. How did you know that you had reached it? If you're revising it for 6 years, how do you know that you've reached it after 6 years? You could have been, you know, gone on for decades.
Well, that was very possible. Actually, at one point, I thought I would be. But it's the same as writing a poem. How do you know when you've written the poem? How do you know when you've finished a poem? Poets speak about, well, okay, I have to abandon this now. I have to let it go out into the world like a child that's matured and is ready. It's in your bones. It's an intuition. Ultimately, you can bring your intellect to bear. You can bring your knowledge of the original poet, which is really a very good idea if you're going to translate very largely at all from any given poet. The poetry of the time, the whole nine yards, the situation of the country the poet is writing in. But ultimately, you can't know except intuitively when you say, yes, this is as close as I can get.
Poet and translator William O'Daly of Auburn is up for a Quill Award for his collection of Pablo Neruda poems translated by him. It's called Still Another Day. Let's hear another one. This is number 26. And you could just read this one in English.
Alrighty. We're getting there. Those reader response cards.
I could start reading it, but I'll let you do it.
If ever a stone was devoured, I am a part of it. I was in the squall, in the wave, in the earthly fire. Honor the stone that was lost. If on a road you find a boy stealing apples and a deaf old man with an accordion, remember that I am the boy, the apples, and that old man. Do not harm me by chasing the boy. Do not strike the old bum. Do not throw apples in the river.
Very nice. You used it. My Spanish is negligible, but Neruda wrote vagabundo and you wrote bum, which strikes me as quite different words. Why did you choose the word bum?
Vagabundo is very much like it sounds, someone who keeps moving, traveling. And in our railroad history in the United States, we talk about railroad bums.
Yes.
They may or may not be homeless sometimes, but they are always moving and always found in a different place at a different time.
You've translated a lot of Neruda's work, isn't that right?
Yes, I have.
Why have you spent so much of your time translating works by Pablo Neruda?
Well, he may be my favorite poet ever. And I believe that his late and posthumous works were not very, very well represented. I found this book in the Stanislaus County Library in Modesto in 1976, and it was written in 2 days of July 1969 and first published in 69 an edition of 500. I had never seen anything written by Pablo Neruda after 1964, so I was shocked. And when I began to research his other books, his other late works, I was floored by how powerful they were and how this was not a new Neruda so much as a Neruda who had matured and was reviewing his entire 45 to 50 years of poetic career, where he had been, what he had written, and not only reinventing himself, but reassessing himself in a very personal way.
Were you reading him in Spanish at that time?
Roughly, yes.
Roughly, yeah. Why did you learn Spanish? Was Spanish something that you had already learned how to read and to write, or were you motivated because of your interest in Neruda?
Well, although my last name is O'Daly, I have a good bit of Mexican blood, Spanish and Basque in me. And I heard a little bit from my grandparents, my paternal grandparents. They'd be in the kitchen at their house, and whenever they didn't want me to understand, they would speak in Spanish, and of course I'd become incredibly interested. And that's when I first got the music of the language into my bones.
Well, let's wrap this up with appropriately the last poem in the book. This is number 28.
So long, visitor. Good day. My poem happened for you, for nobody, for everyone. I beg you, leave me restless. I live with the impossible ocean, and silence bleeds me dry. I die with each wave each day. I die with each day in each wave. But the day does not die, not ever. It does not die. And the wave, it does not die. Gracias.
It's very powerful. When in his life did Neruda write that?
He wrote that in his, I believe, 65th year.
And how long did he live?
Until almost 70.
I see. So it was relatively late in his life. Did he know this was late in his life?
He had a sense that he was dying when he wrote this book. He was actually working on another book called Fin de Mundo, which is very dark, and World's End. And we can't know exactly what he knew about his own death or his own imminent death, but he had leukemia and perhaps prostate cancer as well. And I think sensing that and perhaps not really wanting to know as a way of moving forward, keeping himself moving, keeping his spirits up, he stopped work for 2 days on Fin de Mundo, sat down and wrote this book, which is really a culmination of his entire life.
When are the Quill Awards given?
They're given October 10th, that evening in New York City.
And do you go to that?
Yes, I'll be going to that.
So you'll be sitting there in the crowd waiting to hear who wins?
Or yes,
do you hear beforehand?
I don't think so. I think not until that evening where I'll be sitting in my first tux in 25 years.
Well, that's very exciting. You must be looking forward to it.
I am very much, Jeffrey.
Sure. Well, it's a wonderful collection, Still Another Day. And it was a pleasure meeting you, William.
Well, thank you. Pleasure meeting you, too.
That's William O'Daly, poet, translator, and fiction writer. He's nominated for a 2006 Quill Award for Still Another Day, his translation of a book of poems by Pablo Neruda called Aún. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, another distinguished local poet. It's Taylor Graham of El Dorado County. Her latest award-winning collection is The Downstairs Dance Floor. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Earlier, we met William O'Daly, Quill Award-nominated poet in Auburn. Now we'll meet another distinguished poet who lives in the Sierra region, Taylor Graham from El Dorado County. She's been a published poet for many years. Recently, two of her poems were included in the anthology California Poetry, From the Gold Rush to the Present. Taylor Graham's latest award-winning collection is called The Downstairs Dance Floor. She's in our studio. Taylor Graham, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
I love the title of your collection, The Downstairs Dance Floor. Why did you call it that?
Well, the whole book, I guess you could say, stemmed from an assignment we did in one of my poetry groups. We flipped through a poetry magazine and we saw the title, How the Dead Dance. And we said, now that would be a good assignment. And so I wrote the first poem in the book for that assignment, and the book sort of fell together around that.
What a wonderful concept, How the Dead Dance. How do you interpret that? How do the dead dance?
Well, that poem is about my parents who are now dead, and they were both widowed in their 30s. And so I imagine them dancing with their first spouses in the heavenly dance floor, if you will. But the downstairs dance floor is what they did while they were on this earth.
We're going to hear some poems from you, and let's start with one from the downstairs dance floor, 88 and counting. Is there anything you want to say about that poem before you read it?
Well, my husband Hatch became conservator for his elderly stepfather about 5 years ago, and we started making frequent trips down to Southern California to see how things were going. And I wrote quite a few poems on those trips about family and loss, which is what this book is largely about. And this poem, it's a villanelle, by the way.
What's that?
It's a fixed form, like a sonnet or some of the other established forms. It's quite an old form. It's in six stanzas, all three-line stanzas except for the last, which is four lines. The most famous, probably, villanelle is Dylan Thomas's Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night.
I see.
And there are two. A villanelle has two lines which repeat in each, well, repeat throughout the poem. And in Dylan Thomas's, it's Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night, Rage, Rage Against the Dying of the Light. And he wrote it for his father who was dying. And my poem is about the stepfather, and it's called 88 and Counting. The old man stares ahead, no reason why. The cat stretched sunning on the kitchen sill, and now a flight of crows across the sky. He's got a jigsaw puzzle lying by, half finished years ago, a test of skill. The old man stares ahead. No reason why he couldn't turn the pieces where they lie. But fitting things together calls for will. And now a flight of crows across the sky cast shadows. Do they mean to clarify some age-old question about good and ill? The old man stares ahead. No reason why. For supper, Elena's fixing chicken pie. She always sees an old man gets his fill. And now a flight of crows across the sky. If asked, he whispers he would rather die, but she just wipes her hands. With time to kill, the old man stares ahead, no reason why. And now a flight of crows across the sky.
That's 88 and Counting, read by the poet Taylor Graham. It's from her collection, her latest collection, The Downstairs Dance Floor. Why did you choose to write in the form of a villanelle with these repeating lines?
There's something very obsessive about the villanelle form, with the constant repetition. Getting in a sonnet, you progress somewhere, but in a villanelle, you just keep coming back to the same things, and it seemed appropriate for the way this man was living his later days.
How did you choose which lines you were going to repeat? And if it wasn't obvious, it would be the old man stares ahead, no reason why, and also, and now a flight of crows across the sky. Do you start off by deciding what those key phrases are going to be, or do they emerge as you write the poem?
Well, I've written quite a few villanelles, actually. I like the form. I guess I'm sort of obsessive-compulsive myself. They come in different ways. Sometimes the lines just come to you, and that's the way it is. Other times you start thinking. There's a lot of rhyme, end rhyme, in the poem. The whole thing turns on two different rhymes, so you need words that you've got a lot of rhyming possibilities. For instance, here, why, sky, buy, lie, clarify, pie, die, and sill, skill, will, ill, fill, kill. So you're looking for poems that you've got a lot of choices. I mean, words, words.
It's a very plain-spoken poem. Is that typical of the villanelle, or is that typical of you, or is it typical of both? Or maybe neither.
Well, I like to be plain-spoken in my poems as much as I can and still feel like it's a poem, if that makes any sense.
Well, I think it does, but what makes it a poem when it's... What is it that defines a poem?
That's another really good question. music. I know I'm one of those poets who say if I had been a musician, I might not have to be a poet. But there's got to be some sort of music in it. And I look for a different way of seeing things. A poem should make me see something differently.
I think often, though, the music in a poem is buried deeper than the music in a song, where oftentimes it's more accessible.
Right.
Is that fair?
That's fair. But we can bury a lot of sound that comes through, I think, to the brain without realizing. I'm thinking of internal rhymes and repeating similarities of sounds, plus the rhythm. It doesn't have to be a strict meter, but a certain flow.
Yes. You also are a volunteer search and rescue dog handler, and you've done that for a long time. Why?
Years.
How did you get into that, and why do you do it?
We started out in Alaska, actually, and we had German Shepherd dogs that we were training for various obedience and so forth. And we were in the German Shepherd Dog Club, and someone said, "What else should we be doing besides putting on dog shows and dog training classes?" And somebody said, "How about search and rescue?" And the closest search and rescue dog unit at that time was Washington State. So if there was, for instance, an avalanche, a victim's chances of survival after the first half hour go way down. And there's no way of getting dogs from Washington State in half an hour. So we started doing it, and our dogs loved it so much, and it was very challenging work, and so we just kept doing it.
Have you rescued many people over the years?
A few. We've unfortunately found quite a number that we didn't get to soon enough. I had a real string of unfortunate finds early on, but you keep hoping for the live ones.
One of your collections is called Casualties, Search and Rescue Poems. Are these real stories?
Some are composites. They're all based on kinds of searches we've been on, but I wouldn't say that any specific poem is about a specific missing person.
Well, one of them is called "He Was Wearing a Yellow T-Shirt." Could you read that for us, please?
Yes, and this is one of those composites. It started out as two different searches for little boys that became one poem. He was wearing a yellow T-shirt. We search for child paths in the woods. Where would he go? Cedars bunch gray and blind with cobwebs, berries and honeysuckle, shoulder up higher than a man, not a boy. Birds only sing from the tops and edges. Warblers, orioles, flicks of yellow foliage trick the eye, not a boy. We could be in Transylvania, the Yucatan, backwoods of a suburb. Where is he who walked out of his house and down the civilized street and out of the world? He's finding the way roots pull the red clay over, and quilted creepers, every long bone loosened from its muscle, moving the way stones and twigs do, the intricate small bones of fingers easing out of their joints. By fall, it will all be second nature to him, how the blonde hairs scatter. When it rains, won't matter. Snow melts and runs away kid stuff, and spring shoves up a few yellow tatters, flowers that never grew on a stalk.
That's "He Was Wearing a Yellow T-Shirt," read by the poet Taylor Graham. What responsibility did you feel toward the people that you encountered, either alive or dead, the people who made up the stories in your collection, Casualties?
I'm not sure.
Did you feel any responsibility to check it, to tell them or their families that you were going to write this? Did you feel responsibility to shield their identities? Those kinds of things.
I think that's why most of the poems are composites or... Yeah, really composites, because we've been on so many searches for small boys. We've been on so many searches for drowning victims and earthquake victims and so forth. So really none of the poems are about a specific person.
Was that a difficult collection of poems to write? Because it's really, it's very personal.
Well, difficult. When we go on searches that end happily, usually poems don't come out of those. The poems come out of the searches that don't have a, what you'd say, a satisfactory conclusion. And those are the ones that prey on the mind and eventually do become poems.
There's another poem I really like in your latest collection, The Downstairs Dance Floor, and this one's called Death the Linguist. And before you read it, tell us where this started. It's an interesting poem.
That's probably my favorite also. It was a gift. I woke up. It was a dream that became a poem. I woke up writing this poem. I've studied a number of languages, and I'm fascinated by languages, but they don't usually find a way into my poems. And so that's why I call it a gift, because the dream let me do this. In this poem, querida means sweetheart in Spanish, and Sehnsucht is German for longing.
Okay.
Death the Linguist. I'm feeling lightheaded, dreamy when he calls me querida, so I hardly wonder how he can do that D that sounds like TH, not quite touching behind the teeth, when he hasn't even got a tongue. Breeze as soft as blue breath, fading into whisper, a sigh that rises from below the sternum, what might be the solar plexus if he had an ounce of flesh. He speaks of Sehnsucht for a land I've never visited and always wished to go, or perhaps some place I once was and somehow got broken off from, a place where all languages are fluent and all genders agree. And now he's stringing sounds I'm almost gone enough to understand. Maybe they mean the hoisin sauce is such a bargain in Vietnamese, or blue tiles of the Lion Gate in an ancient Moorish dialect. It doesn't matter. I close my eyes and open my lips to let the tongue float free.
Death the Linguist, read by the poet Taylor Graham. When you woke up writing this poem, as you said, what did you do? Did you actually jump out of bed and start actually writing it?
Well, I grabbed a piece of paper and a pencil. I always have those by the bed, and just started scribbling as fast as I could.
Do you consciously try to make use of your dreams?
Yes, I do.
How do you do that?
Well, I write down as much as I can. When I wake up, because I know it'll be gone, and then I just go from there.
Yes. Do you prepare yourself when going to bed for dreaming?
I don't know. I have the window open and I listen to the owls if they're out, and I look at the moon, and maybe that helps.
Sounds like it would be a good start. What's your next collection? Are you working on it yet?
I have a couple that are going out to the contests all the time and coming back. And I would like to have a full-length collection out one of these days, but I hope it would be more the kind of poems I like to write about dogs and foxes and things like that rather than this new book, which is about family and loss. That's really a departure for me, this newest book.
And why do you prefer to write about animals and nature than about people?
I think I feel closer to animals and nature. We live up in the foothills at the end of a little road. We can't see our closest neighbors, and so I do feel very close to the animals and the trees.
Well, Taylor Graham, thank you so much for sharing some of your poems today, including a couple from your latest collection, The Downstairs Dance Floor. It was nice meeting you.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, a so-called story booth is touring the Sierra, recording people's stories about the Sierra Nevada mountains. You'll hear a clip from one story and find out where the story booth is going next. We'll be right back. Listening to Inside from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We started our show with two poets from the Sierra region. It's fitting to end our show today with an effort to record as many personal stories as possible about the Sierra. The story booth is touring the region. Many stories are already recorded and more will be taped this month at events in several communities. The story booth is a project of Saving the Sierra, Voices of Conservation in Action. Project co-director Catherine Stifter joins us from Nevada County. Catherine, welcome to Insight.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Why are you collecting people's stories about the Sierra?
Well, you know, people have lots of stories to tell, and in terms of our focus on conservation, you'd think we'd be talking to environmentalists and conservationists, people who are already organized, but in fact, just about everybody who lives up here, just about everybody who knows and loves the Sierra has some connection to wanting to save some parts of it, whether it's their favorite places that they'd like to remain just as they are every time they visit it, or whether it's a ranchers who want to keep their family business together for the rest of generations in their family.
Well, your recordings of people's stories is in progress. There are a lot more that you're still going to be doing, but you have one for us today. Could you tell us who we're going to hear?
Yes, you're going to be listening to Attilio Genasi, 97-year-old rancher from the Sierra Valley north of Truckee, and he is still working on his ranch and where he was born and raised and where six generations of his family have ranched, Swiss Italians who came here in the 1800s.
And he's quite a guy. Let's hear him.
I'm Attilio Genasi. My folks came here from Switzerland in 93, and they got married and they bought land in Sierra Valley. I was born here in the valley, lived here all my life. Farming is a way of life. You have to love it. You don't farm and say, well, when I'm 65, I'll sell and retire and go to the city. That thought never entered my mind. I'm still working at 97. Like I told my family, I hope I die with my boots on out there working on the ranch. The ranch becomes part of you. It's not a business that you can shut the door and walk away from. I get up sometime when the snow's on the ground, you see a blanket of snow. You can hear the train on the other end of the valley, 18 miles. You hear the clickety-clack of the trains that go by. It's so quiet and peaceful here. And I think I want to save it for posterity. The land does not belong to me. The land belongs to future generations. And the land also belongs to the general public. They drive through this valley. They enjoy it. It doesn't cost them a penny, and it doesn't cost me a penny. It's one of the natural wonders that's there for humanity, and we dare not destroy it any more than we'd cap the geysers in Yellowstone or put the Bridal Veil Falls of Yosemite in a pipe. I think we have a natural wonder here that I'll do my best to preserve.
What a wonderful person. Catherine, how did you find Attilio? Do you know him?
I don't know him personally. He's a somewhat famous character in the Sierra Valley, being one of the first ranchers to place conservation easements on his quite large ranch as a way to preserve open space. And as we were researching some radio stories for the other parts of our project, many people directed us to him. He's been celebrated in magazine articles, but it was such a wonderful opportunity to get a chance to meet him and his son, Jim, along with many of the other people in the Sierra Valley when we went up there to report stories and attend the Birds, Barns, and Barbecue event that they have there annually.
I did a double take this morning when I was listening to it, when he said, my folks came here in 93, and I thought, wait a second, that was only 13 years ago. And then I realized he's talking about 1893.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the great things about asking people to tell their stories is that you learn a lot of history. These stories really have the power to draw us into issues, whether it's conservation or history or culture and heritage and how to preserve rural life in the Sierra, and really helps us to understand it. And that's part of the reason that we're going collecting in so many different places. We're going as far north as the Sierra Valley and as far south as Fresno County right now, and we'd love to go other places too.
Catherine Stifter is project co-director for Saving the Sierra. She has a story booth touring the Sierra in Nevada, gathering personal stories for a radio series and a website about Sierra conservation. How exactly does a story booth work? If someone goes to one of the events this month that you're going to, what can they expect and what should they bring to the process?
Bring yourself. There's nothing really to bring. We'll have a booth where some of our fabulous interns who have been funded by the Center for Sierra Nevada Studies at Sierra College, they're the ones that are helping us bring the mobile recording studio. And I say studio with kind of tongue in cheek. It's two suitcases full of digital gear that we carry along. And we try to entice people to sit down for 15 minutes to record a story and have their picture taken. And those recordings are edited and their photos are also edited. And they'll appear on our website for everybody to listen to on our story booth page of our website. So what will happen is you'll get a chance to look at a few questions that we've kind of designed as an open-ended way to get people talking. It's less about you coming with a prepared story than coming prepared to enter into a dialogue with our fabulous interns from Sierra College. And one of the questions I'll ask you, Jeffrey, it's pretty easy. Tell me about your first memory of being in the Sierra.
Well, let's see. That would be 1990. I came to California in 89, and I do vividly remember going to the Sierra for the first time. My mother was visiting from Scotland, and we drove from Santa Cruz up into the mountains. And I remember being surprised at how fast we were driving through the mountains, because in Scotland the mountainous areas don't have these freeways. They're sort of narrow winding roads, and Interstate 80 is such an exhilarating way to go through the mountains. And I got a speeding ticket. And then we visited Tahoe, and I just never seen anything like it in my life, the beauty and the vastness and the sun. And then the day ended up wonderfully, believe it or not. We stayed in a casino hotel in Reno, and our room was upstairs, and we were facing the Eastern Sierra. And that, the view of the Eastern Sierra, is something that I'll never shake. So that's my memory.
See, everybody's got a story to tell. It's easy to do this. It's fun. It's a short little experience. And we have other questions that get kind of deeper into conservation issues and what work people are doing or want to see doing, or places or ways of life that they'd like to see saved. So it's an open-ended set of questions. You get to practice. And then in a month or so, they end up on the website.
Can you give us examples of a couple of places that the story booth is going to in the next few weeks?
Yes, these are all weekend events. We're going to be at the American River Conservancy in Coloma on October 7th. October 8th, we're real proud to be part of the Chiaka Maidu Tribe's Indigenous Peoples Days events here in Nevada City near my hometown. We're headed down to the Intermountain Nursery Peace and Harvest Arts Festival in Prather. That's pretty far south by Fresno. And Loma Rica Ranch Heritage Harvest Festival in Grass Valley, and then the Sierra Business Council annual meeting in Yosemite.
There's a link to more information about Saving the Sierra on our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Catherine, we've made an appointment for you to come back on when you've got more clips for us, and that's in November.
Terrific. We've got about 21 stories on our website now. We expect to have more than 100, so I'll be just thrilled to come back and play you some of our best.
Great. Thanks so much, Catherine. That's Catherine Stifter, project co-director for Saving the Sierra. The Story Booth is touring the Sierra in Nevada this month and has been already, and is gathering personal stories for a radio series and a website about Sierra conservation. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up on the KXJZ stations, the European Union wants French vintners to dig up some of their vines, make less wine, and pay more attention to American consumers. That's Bordeaux winemakers struggling to compete in the global wine market. That story in the day's news next on The World. Insight staff includes technical director Mark Jones, assistant producer Jen Picard, and senior producer Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Thank you for joining us. California high school students are improving according to recently released results for two major tests, but are tests really a good indication of achievement? Next time in Insight, State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jack O'Connell and other education experts tell you about the STAR program and the high school exit exam. Plus, you'll hear how California charter schools are faring. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.